You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles, and this week we're bringing you a slightly different kind of episode. As we mentioned last week, my co-host Andrew Day is leaving Non-Zero to join the American Conservative as a senior editor. So in the next few weeks, we'll be breaking our typical format a bit. Sometimes that will mean having Robert Wright join me for the first half of the conversation, and sometimes, like this week, it'll mean just sharing an interview with an interesting expert or journalist. For today's episode, I spoke with longtime progressive journalist Natasha Hakimi-Zapata about her forthcoming book, Another World is Possible, published by the New Press. For this book, Natasha traveled all around the world to find examples of successful domestic policies implemented by other countries that the U.S. should try to emulate. The conversation is in many ways an attempt at being hopeful in the early days of the Trump administration. I try to focus on good programs that could draw genuine bipartisan support within the U.S. as well, like improved family leave policies. This episode is fully available to the public, but if you like our work and want to get access to all of our bonus content, including overtime segments of podcast episodes, as well as the paywalled portions of the Non-Zero newsletter, you can subscribe at nonzero.substack.com. Now, here is my conversation with Natasha. Natasha Hakimi-Zapata, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, very happy to have you on. Today we are going to be talking about your very interesting new book, do you want to remind everyone the title of that before we get started?
Sure. So it's out with the New Press. It's called Another World is Possible, Lessons for America from Around the Globe.
Awesome. And it's a very interesting book. I did read it in the last few weeks. You did a very impressive job of kind of going to a wide range of countries and seeing, what types of lessons their local policies may be able to bring to the U.S. and maybe to other countries, too. I think this is really a global book, which is part of what I really enjoyed about it. But just to get started, I thought I'd maybe sort of ask you the general question of, why did you want to write this book, and how did you select some of these case studies? Because you go everywhere from, you do some of the more typical ones, like maybe Finland and Norway, but you also find yourself in Uruguay and Singapore. I'm kind of curious how that all came together.
Yeah, thanks so much, Connor. So first of all, I'm a journalist. I've been working in media for 15 years now. And during the same period that I've been working in progressive media mostly, I've also been living abroad in a number of different countries. I've lived in about 8 countries. And I started to feel like a lot of the issues that I was reporting on that we weren't getting much traction on in the States, I was actually experiencing firsthand how other countries had solved those problems, or at least were addressing them more effectively. And I thought that they were really inspirational stories that we don't hear enough about in the States. And I really wanted to sort of share those stories in a story format. Since you've read the book, they're told very much to sort of sound like stories that you can kind of tell your friends as well,
yeah.
With a lot of policy detail. And so that was kind of the professional inspiration behind it. The more personal inspiration, and I talk about this a bit in the book, comes from my own family experience from a healthcare incident that happened when about over 10 years ago now, my mom, who was an undocumented immigrant for many years, who couldn't afford health insurance for a large part of her life, had undiagnosed, untreated diabetes and actually had her right foot amputated. And at the time, I had lived in countries before that moment where there was universal healthcare. And I found myself wondering how she was ever going to be able to afford not just insulin to keep her alive, but just any sort of treatment moving forward. And it just seemed like an unnecessary question, given that I'd been in places where that didn't come into play. So that's the motivation behind the book. And in terms of how I selected the policies, as a journalist, I really wanted to give, again, this kind of story perspective. I wanted to go to the countries and really hear from not just policymakers and activists, but actually just everyday people, what these policies are like on the ground. And I wanted to say, like you said, I wanted to take a kind of more global perspective. So I didn't want to just stay in Scandinavia, which is where a lot of these, you know, when we talk about social democratic policy, we're often talking about Scandinavia. And I did go to Finland and I did go to Norway because they do have great ideas there. But I wanted to go to Uruguay and I wanted to go to Costa Rica and New Zealand and Singapore and really see for myself what other parts of the world are doing in terms of solving the same problems that we have at home.
No, absolutely. And it is a very interesting book. Again, I recommend people do check it out. But maybe we should start by kind of digging into one of the case studies that really jumped out to me, which was your discussion of Uruguay and its transition. It's really kind of remarkably rapid transition to green energy in the past. It happened really over the course of like a decade. And I guess what stood out to me most, perhaps, is that the argument for making that transition wasn't really about climate change at all, or at least that wasn't the main thing. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about how that transition happened?
Yeah, absolutely. So Uruguay, despite being a relatively low-income country at the time, greened its grid, as you said, almost 100% in under a decade, which is remarkable for a number of reasons. But if you kind of go back to the start of it, it actually has a lot to do with the financial crisis. So what was happening is that because Uruguay doesn't have any naturally occurring fossil fuels, they were highly dependent on hydroelectric. But every time there were droughts, which started to happen with more severity due to climate change and other factors, the government, which is in charge of energy, of providing energy and generating it, transmitting it through its public utility, UTE, would go into a financial crisis because it would have to import so many fossil fuels from neighboring countries, Argentina, Brazil, at exorbitant prices. And they would have rolling blackouts and power cuts. And it was just incredibly disruptive, not just to civilian life, but also to, you know, governance, to businesses, to everything. And so in the early 2000s, around 2005, you have a new left-wing government with Frente Amplio, and then with Pepe Mujica comes in around 2010. And even before he comes into power, he decides that they don't know how long Frente Amplio is going to be in power. And so he wants to have sort of four key issues that are plaguing Uruguay. He wants to put together these cross-party coalition agreement in which the whole country or their elected representatives essentially together decide how they're going to address certain issues so that once they were no longer in power, there was sort of an assurance that that they would continue to address them. And one of those main issues was electricity, was energy, and how to essentially transition away from fossil fuels and from this huge issue that they were having. And the solution came together very quickly in under 10 years. As I said, they essentially brought in a ton of wind, a ton of solar, some biomass as well, and just a lot of really interesting, scrappy solutions, and really proved that as long as you have a mix of renewables, you can have a very stable grid. Because part of, you know, one of the criticisms of renewable energy, which we hear often, is that the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. But as long as you have all of these different moving parts, you can, as Uruguay has shown, actually provide the energy that your citizens need.
Yeah. Yeah, and I found, again, that underlying rationale. It's almost, I don't want to call it national security because it's not quite that, but it's like a human security question. It's the ability to provide these services to the people. And we don't need to jump right to the U.S. here, but there is a sense in which the U.S., despite its kind of extraordinary natural resources, does have a potential security problem. Like a lot of our security can be undermined by what happens in global oil markets, and a lot of some of our most vulnerable places can come when oil exporting states make decisions that we don't like, whether that has to do with oil or other things. And this idea of sort of energy independence through renewable energy, I think is very interesting.
Yeah, it was really fascinating because it's like you said earlier, they didn't really talk about, even, you know, I interviewed a lot of electrical engineers and people at these wind farms and solar farms, and no one really talked about climate change. Oftentimes it was about an economic issue, it was about a security issue, about energy sovereignty, things like this. It wasn't really about climate change, even though obviously, like I said, the climate crisis was affecting Uruguay in that it was making the droughts more severe. But I was also actually reporting there when the when Russia invaded Ukraine, and I live in London, I live in the UK, and I could hear from home there was all of this panic about, oh my God, we import so much gas from Russia, what's going to happen to our energy prices, to all of these different questions. And that just wasn't a question in Uruguay. No one, obviously they cared for different reasons, but they have that problem solved.
No, that's very interesting. That's very, and I guess, can you talk a little bit more about, well, one thing that jumped out to me as well, another thing that jumped out was the fact that they had these sort of like municipal bond programs. They had all these different ways to get people engaged and potentially even give them the opportunity to both participate in the project and even make a little bit of a profit on it. I'm kind of curious if you could talk more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So they had what were called these small saver programs where you could invest in the publicly owned solar farms and wind farms. It was actually mostly the wind farms. So UTE, which I talked about earlier, which is the public utility that for a large part of Uruguay's history had actually been in charge of every aspect of energy. And so it was the generation, transmission, and distribution were all done by this public utility. And what happened in 2010, once they started to decide to green their grid, is that they opened up the generation side to private companies as well. And so you had private wind farms and solar farms. But UTE decided to keep some of that under their control. And so they actually have UTE-owned, publicly owned wind farms. And they decided, again, it's not a very high-income country, that in order to sort of get investment for it, but also for you know, citizens to kind of partake in the success story that was in the making, that they would have this small saver program where you could sort of buy a share in a wind farm somewhere in Uruguay. And it was extremely successful. They at some point had to sort of stop taking small savers investments because they had too many.
Yeah, that's just really, and it's the kind of thing that, you know, I guess as I was reading through the book, I was just thinking about, you know, there is a sense in America that like privately owned things are worse, or rather that publicly owned things are worse, and that it is challenging to kind of get people involved in a direct way. I thought that was really interesting because it shows kind of an interesting way that something public can really be felt in a tangible way by citizens, and that can help get them engaged. But then, you know, another challenge that sort of arises in this, and you've already sort of hinted at it, is the fact that, you know, when we're trying to apply this lesson to the United States, obviously our utilities, because of years of policy in this direction, are private rather than public. So I guess, how would you envision getting over that sort of hurdle as we try to deal with the transition to green energy production?
Yeah, I really think that public ownership in terms of things like electric utilities is so important. And you have cases in the US, I think it was Rhode Island, where basically activists got together and pushed for public ownership of their local grid. And so I do think it is very possible to bring, you know, our very disparate electric grid, which is, you know, in the hands of a ton of different private companies, at least under state ownership. I would love to see that. And to then, you know, one of the things that Uruguay really shows is that having that as the center of a transition is really important, because you can kind of do it all at once rather than negotiate with all of these different companies. I think in the US, even if you had sort of an order down from the federal government that everything had to be greened right away, you would really struggle to do that because of all of these different parts. And so I do think that that's a really key part of it. And right now, I think only 16% of the grid and of the distribution of electricity is public or federally owned. So it's really a tiny percentage. It doesn't mean that we can't bring it under control, like I said. The other thing that's really interesting is that this would actually save us a lot of money. And maybe that's where we can think about how this investment would sort of pay off later on. Yeah. There was an Oxford study I think it was 2022, that said that the world could save about $12 trillion by 2050 if we could ditch fossil fuels, right? So it's definitely an economic question. And again, coming back to that.
In what sense is it, sorry to jump in, but in what sense is it cheaper to do this? Like how does that save money? Just maybe flesh that out a little bit for listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so already solar and wind have been getting cheaper and cheaper as time has gone on. So that's one of the things that happened in Uruguay is that, you know, they established all of these contracts with these private companies for wind turbines and solar panels and for running these different farms. But they, in order to create security for the investment, they have them over 20 or 10 years, 10 to 20 years. And during that time, a lot of the people who were involved in the transition were telling me, yeah, we watched the price of this plummet. So mm-hmm. It's gotten to the point where oftentimes it's actually still, it's cheaper now to have wind or solar farms than it is to have a fossil fuel generator. Mm-hmm. So that's one aspect. The other aspect, and I don't know how this would work in the States, but certainly one of the ways that Uruguay has not only saved a ton of money, so it was, you know, spending so millions and millions every time there was a drought in order to import fossil fuels. They now actually export excess energy because they have so much green energy that they can export it to Argentina and Brazil, who they were, you know, importing from before and making millions. So there's that aspect to it as well. But there's a way that it can actually pay off.
Yeah, very cool. All right. I want to zoom out in a little bit and talk about sort of the broad connective things here. But in the meantime, I think that one more case study could be useful. And I think that the other case study that really stood out to me was Norway. So again, this is a Nordic country. So people, it's almost a joke that, oh, they're better than us at everything, whatever. But I thought that what stood out here is that, you know, in Norway, you're really talking about family-friendly policies. You're talking about sort of policies that have enabled Norwegian men and women to have a more equitable role at home, but that also result in things like lower divorce rates, things like lower chance of families falling apart. And I think that is quite interesting because it's the type of thing that has the ability, I think, to really appeal both to liberals and conservatives within the U.S. So can you tell us a little bit more about all the ways in which Norway's sort of family-friendly policies are different than those of the U.S. and why it's so much better in your view?
Yeah. Norway is a great example of how investing in young families is actually an economic no-brainer. And so I actually, a lot of the policies I looked at, I think of them as economic no-brainers now. Going back a little bit, it's important to note that the U.S. is one of seven countries in the world that doesn't have some form of federally backed paid parental leave. And it's the only country in the OECD with zero nationwide statutory paid leave, even though 94% of Americans polled say that it would be good for families, as you were just saying. And so moving to Norway, what's really interesting, and I really want to stress this, is that as I was there, and I asked this to a lot of people, I realized that it's not that Norway was somehow more feminist or somehow, you know, more interested in inequality than we are in the States or in other Western countries. For them, around the 1970s, it was really a question of economics. They wanted to move towards full employment. This is how they decided that they wanted to grow their economy. And part of the way they wanted to do that was to bring women into the formal workforce. And so they made traditionally, you know, unpaid labor, like caregiving, that women traditionally did, paid labor, and often brought them into the public sector. But as I did that, they also realized that they had to provide some sort of support if they were expecting people to continue to have children, which they did want people to do.
Right.
And so they've, over the years from the 1970s on, and it's taken a lot of different forms, instituted different paid parental leave policies. And the way that it looks today is that both parents have a combined year, so the first year of life of their newborn, that they can, that one of them can be home with their child at 100% of their salary covered. And on top of that, once that year is done, they have highly subsidized childcare where everyone from the age of one can go to a high quality daycare and pay a maximum of around $400 a month, regardless of if it's private or public daycare. This had just enormous benefits. So if we look at the economic point of view again, there was a finance minister of Norway that said that thanks to this policy, there's been an increase since the 1970s of, or, you know, the family-friendly policies all put together and women being in the workforce, of about 20% GDP per capita increase. They've gotten a lot closer to closing the gender pay gap than we have. And as you were saying, it's really changed family dynamics, but also workplace dynamics. So the relationships have really benefited, I think, especially from a part of it that is why I chose Norway. They were the first to have this, what they call papa perm, or daddy leave, daddy quota, where a portion, which is now 3 months, of the paid parental leave is for dad or co-parent. They're very progressive. So, you know, when I say mom, dad, it's like co-parents just generally, that it's non-transferable. So that really means that in those 3 months in which mom has to go back to work or school, she can't be at home as well. Dad has to not be assistant to mom, which ends up happening sometimes, but actually be a caregiver of their own right. So like a genuine co-parent, you know, and find out for themselves what it's like to be a primary caregiver. And this has had a huge impact in the workplace as well, because you have a situation in which workers are going to take possibly the same amount of parental leave if they have children, because you can divide it in half. And you have a certain amount of days that you can take, that each of you get, to take a sick leave if your child is sick. And so you're, you know, again, regardless of gender, you're equally able to stay home with your child. And this has just created a lot more understanding about families in the workplace, and less discrimination towards women. There's also health benefits. I mean, I could go on and on about the benefits.
Yeah, sure.
Kind of lastly is that they do have much lower maternity and infant mortality rates than we do in the States, and other major health issues. And all of this, it won't surprise you to know, is why it's an incredibly popular policy in Norway. And so whereas the right in even in Norway in the 1970s wasn't really on board with this policy, now you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone on any part of the political spectrum that would try to take away paid parental leave.
Yeah, absolutely. And how do they handle the like funding structure of it? Does the I'm sure you mentioned this in the chapter, but I don't remember off the top of my head. Do they pull is this part from employers? Is this kind of government funding raised through taxes? Like, what's the kind of general split?
Yeah, so it's pretty much entirely through general taxation. So you have the option to either have like I said, about a year between two of you at 100% salary. And if you want to extend that, you can get 80% of your salary. So then it's a few more months. If the government doesn't fully cover your salary, there is a limit. Your oftentimes employers will step in and cover the rest of their employee's salary. And this is largely seen as sort of not just a nice thing to do, but something that keeps your employees happy and, will make it more likely that they'll come back after their leave.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, it's very much sort of an idea of investing investing in people, investing in young people in particular, like giving them the opportunities to break out. And I think it's so interesting how what is essentially, you know, what is a policy that, you know, you could phrase as progressive or whatever, but that is very even, ends up having all these positive results that aren't necessarily about the exact design of the policy, but that, you know, allow you to have sort of more like sharing of gendered work in the home, things like that. I think that's a very impressive sort of social result of it. But I'm curious to get your thought too of, you know, how do you see this type of thing applying back in the United States? How would we take lessons from this and apply them here at home?
Yeah, it's really interesting because it, as you were saying earlier, this is something that's sort of popular across the spectrum, even in the US. And you've had Trump during the last administration actually be the first Republican to talk about paid parental leave in his 2020 State of the Union. And they came close to passing some form of paid family and sick leave in the States. Oftentimes, the policies that have come up have been sort of a combination of both. And there's a lot of different forms that policy has taken. So they've been talking about, I mean, under Trump, there was talk of sort of borrowing from future families in the form of the child tax credit, and which, you know, we could get into the child tax credit, but generally, I think it makes a lot more sense rather than having these, I think, too low tax credits, which, of course, help address child poverty, but don't go far enough. To actually directly subsidize daycares, directly give parents paid parental, like federally backed paid parental leave in some form, at the very least, mandate a certain amount. So you actually have federal workers in the U.S. get 12 weeks paid parental leave. That happened, again, under Trump. It's not impossible to have something like this in the States. And what's really important to note is that actually paid leave policies are really popular. In the general election in November, one of the kind of surprising things, at least it was surprising to me to see, was that a number of what we would consider sort of deep red states passed paid sick leave policies. Yeah. It's not the same as paid parental leave, but like I said, it's paid leave. And so you had Missouri, Nebraska, and Alaska all pass with pretty big majorities paid sick leave. I mean, in Nebraska, it was like 74%. So yeah, these are policies that, yes, we would consider progressive, but that are actually just pragmatic and popular across the board.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess it really is so, in a time in the U.S. in particular where daycare is becoming this, like, I mean, it's tens of thousands of dollars a year for a lot of families, and it's an extraordinary cost. And there just must be a really substantial amount of that is essentially price gouging from these daycares. And it's also not cheap to employ people. I'm sure that they've got all their expenses. But I mean, you know, having a system where the government is able to at least put its finger on the scale a little bit more seems to really make eminent sense in this case.
I mean, we have public schools, right? And so it's not like we don't already have a precedent for this. It's sort of extending that just for when kids are younger.
Yeah, so one theme that comes out in this one and that I think appears elsewhere is this idea that the U.S. sort of spends inefficiently, both spends actual government funding inefficiently and maybe allocates private funding in ways that cause people to spend more than they otherwise could have for these things. Why do you think that the U.S., as a general matter, is so much less effective than maybe these Nordic countries or some of the other ones that you looked at in just allocating funds towards things that work?
I'm a really big believer in universal programs. I think universal programs, especially when paired with progressive tax systems, and we definitely need to make our tax system more progressive. Mm. The wealthiest Americans are not paying their fair share, neither are corporations. But when you do have those things working together, universal programs are just better overall, not just because they're more equitable and they create more social solidarity. You know, there's no off-ramp for the wealthiest Americans, but they're also just less wasteful. One of the policies we haven't talked about that I looked at were universal pensions in New Zealand. And I was told over and over again how It was easy to understand because everyone got the same flat rate, right, and it was paid for by general taxation. And there was just sort of an age and residency requirement. And it was incredibly easy to run because everyone got the same amount. So you're not wasting all of this, all of these resources on means testing, which can often be arbitrary in terms of like the line where you say like, this is below the poverty line, this isn't. And back to this question of social solidarity, in the US, we live in a society in which if you're extremely wealthy, you can have this off-ramp, as I called it earlier, where you can kind of afford the best of everything. You can afford the best healthcare, you can afford the best childcare, elder care. But the majority of Americans, despite living in the wealthiest country in the history of the planet, do not have access to these things or have very limited access to these things and really struggle. And so creating these universal programs would not just like make economic sense, would not be less, just be less wasteful. It would just be more fair, it'd be fair to actually have, for everyone to have access to these things. The really interesting thing as well is that there's this kind of, I would call it a myth, that Americans don't pay as much tax as other countries do. And Matt Brunig has this really interesting piece from a few years ago in Jacobin, where he talks about how if you take into consideration health insurance payments, which you should consider kind of a form of labor tax because of the Affordable Care Act sort of mandating that everyone has to have it, and you add that to other labor tax rates and you put them together and you compare them to other countries, you actually have a situation in which Americans are paying some of the highest labor tax rates in the OECD. So Norway, where we're talking about, they have universal health care, they have these great family-friendly policies, they're paying about 32% on average, and we're paying about 43%. This is, you know, a married person with two children. And so the money is there. It's already kind of being collected. Again, as I said, I think we could have a much more progressive tax system and close loopholes for wealthy Americans and corporations. But a lot of times it's an issue of we're not actually structuring programs in a way that are the most effective, that are the least wasteful, that are actually reaching the people that they need to reach. And healthcare is another one of them. I mean, 27% of household spending goes on healthcare, according to some polls. That's a huge amount of money when you consider that in other countries like the UK, it's closer to 0% oftentimes because it's free at the point of delivery. So this is money that can be used for a lot of other things, including making healthcare better.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious how you think about, you know, obviously, while we're recording this a few days before he enters office, but Trump is about to be president again. The kind of Republican side of the aisle does balk at a lot. You know, there is a big push now for reducing taxes again. There's this Elon Musk, you know, reduce government spending thing. I guess what's your vision for a political path towards being able to create more of a progressive tax system? And I guess, are these sort of related? I can see the idea that, you know, you've got to show results and you put those together and you can almost run on, you know, these cool, not means tested universal things. But I guess, how do we build toward that?
Yeah. So one of the really great things that I saw as I was looking at all of these policies was that some of the best solutions actually come from the darkest times in these countries' histories. And so I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know what it's going to be like under the second Trump administration. We can kind of guess based on the first one. And then, like you said, we can guess based on people like Musk and what they're saying. But it's not really clear to me right this moment what's going to happen. If it is going to be a dark time, I think that we can also learn from these countries that it's not the time to despair. It's actually the time to organize and to hope for better. And so, you know, the NHS in the UK, the National Health Service, came out of World War II. Uruguay, we talked about, came out of the greening their grid that came out of these droughts and financial catastrophes. And economic hardships in Finland, Estonia, Norway, Singapore. I could go on and on. All of these were the motivating factors behind these policies. And they're all very different policies, different choices that were made in order to move out of these difficult times. I think that if we can't make progress on a federal level, it's really important right now to focus on growing movements with a clear agenda. And we need to know what we're fighting for. We need to understand what the payoff could be. And that's kind of one of the reasons I wanted to share these stories is, you know, these are successful stories that we can kind of point to and say, hey, like this works somewhere else. It can work here too. And really build broad coalitions beyond electoral politics and beyond elections. We need to kind of be coming together and fighting for these things on a local and state level, and yes, on a national scale too.
Yeah, and how do we deal with, these are all highly challenging questions, so I appreciate you even jumping at them because they are challenging. But like, how do you deal with, for example, one that you have in the book is you talk about Portugal's process of decriminalizing drugs, about their kind of very interesting programs that sort of help to discourage people from continuing to use and sort of either help them to use safe needles, different things like that. It's a very sort of unique approach to drugs that's had a lot of success. And then we saw an attempt to recreate those successes in Oregon that seems that fell short insofar as it was repealed, but also seemed to have left open, I guess, lots of room for political attacks that eventually kind of facilitated that rollback. So are there any sort of lessons that we could learn from that effort or from similar ones to implement these policies at a local level?
Oregon, and I really admire what they were trying to do with drug decriminalization in Oregon, because I really do think that given my research in Portugal, that needs to be at the heart of any drug policy moving forward. If you have a situation in which people are afraid that they're going to be imprisoned if they try and get treatment or any sort of support, or if they get caught with drugs for personal use, we're not going to make much progress. And we've seen that in the States. Like, so the war on drugs has not been effective. It's been, again, incredibly wasteful in terms of economic and human life. I do think decriminalization is key, and we do have a lot of harm reduction and treatment programs already in the U.S., but I think there's a lot of sort of fear around imprisonment that's still related to drug use. What happened in Oregon is it's actually a really good example of how we need to internalize the right lessons from these policies. So in Portugal, what they did was they made drug use a public health issue, not a criminal issue. And that was, again, this is where decriminalization kind of comes in. And that allowed them to sort of open up this perspective of, okay, we need to treat people who do have problematic drug use. So not just any drug use, like if they need some sort of support, as people who need health support. So they set up these CDTs, they're called dissuasion commissions, in which if you're caught by the police with any amount of any drug that's sort of for personal use that you're not trying to sell, you will get a sort of ticket that's kind of like a speeding ticket, and you have to go into a dissuasion commission near your home a few days later and sit down and talk with two people on this commission. Usually it's like a social worker, sometimes a legal expert, something like this, and just have a conversation about your drug use and what brought you to do this. And I spent some time at one of these, and I could see how effective it was to actually have those conversations. A lot of what they were telling me they were kind of preventative conversations in some form, in that if you're already having a conversation with someone early on in their relationship to drugs, let's say, you can make sure that they know what support is in place in case that it does change. in Oregon, these dissuasion commissions were replaced by a hotline, which really, you lost a lot of the personal touch there and ended up being incredibly ineffective and incredibly expensive. Mm. But at the same time, although I really sort of disagree with that aspect of the way that they applied this policy, a lot of other issues were blamed on drug decriminalization, when actually in California, where drug use was not decriminalized, you had a lot of the same issues. You had a rise in homelessness. The fentanyl crisis sort of spiraled. So what people who were working on the ground in Oregon said was that a lot of the times people didn't actually know that drugs had been decriminalized. Mm. They were making these choices based on the desperation that they were facing by losing their homes and being on the streets.
Yeah. Yeah, and maybe that's a very interesting case study. We don't have too much time left, so maybe it's not too useful to dig into it now. But I do recommend that people read up on that and check it out, because the question of drug decriminalization like that, I think, has a lot of potential in the U.S., just like it did in Portugal. And I think that the Oregon case could well just be a setback more than a permanent end. But maybe to conclude, I guess my last question would be, you know, you've talked about how moments of crisis are likely to be the thing that kind of sets off these monumental changes to how governments do things. Can you talk a little bit more about sort of the moment of crisis that you see us in now and why that might be a reason for hope?
I really found that a lot of times when we talk about these policies, and you know, as someone on the left in the U.S. as well, we kind of see them as an ideological necessity in a way. Like, this is what we ideologically think should happen. But as I saw in all of these different countries, it's oftentimes a question of pragmatism. And once people have experience with these policies, it's really hard to take it away. And so Aneirin Bevin, who is the founder of the National Health Service in the UK, he has this great quote, which I'm going to misquote a little bit now, where he talks about how it's the NHS is on the verge of becoming so popular that even our enemies are going to start taking credit for it. And I think that if we really try to build movements around policies that are broadly popular, that, you know, maybe, and this is part of the way that I structured the book, maybe someone is interested in paid parental leave but isn't as interested in renewable energy, we can still kind of build a coalition around paid parental leave, that maybe at some point we can build something else with that person with renewable energy, but it doesn't have to be the case. Like, we don't have to agree on everything in order to kind of progress and move forward. And so I think what I'm really trying to say is that we have to keep remembering that there are policies that are popular across the spectrum, even in the U.S., and that during these more difficult times that we may be facing, it's actually important to come together and get ready for the next moment we'll have an opportunity to pass any of this legislation, and, you know, build allies and hold our leaders accountable as much as possible.
Yeah, and I think I guess one thing I'd connect that to, and then I'll probably wrap this up, is that you know, we talk a lot about foreign policy on this show. This book isn't really about foreign policy per se, but that's such an area where there is significant overlap on ideas around there should be less militarism, there should be less sort of sending U.S. troops abroad for these various missions that are unlikely to succeed. And I think that something, again, helpful that your book has laid out is that there are all these different issues where there could be much more sort of bipartisan or across the spectrum, maybe outside of partisan agreement, that people are simply not seeing because they're kind of locked into these partisan lenses. So that is something that I really appreciate about the book. Do you have any response to that thought? Or
no, I really appreciate that reading because I really did want people from across the political spectrum to be able to pick up the book and find something interesting in it. I want us to really start talking about these issues as not left or right, but just more humane approaches to governance, to policy, to our daily lives, you know, to improving people's condition, daily conditions. So thank you for that.
Yeah, well, of course. So anyway, the book again, thank you, Natasha, for coming on the show. The book is Another World is Possible from the New Press. So yeah, Natasha, thanks again so much for joining me. This was a great conversation.
Thanks so much, Connor. I appreciate it.